defend Mexican interests, what it views as the elite interests in the economic sphere.
Laura Cross, I want to thank you very much for being with us, director of the Mexico City-based America's Program for the Center for International Policy. Happy birthday, John Randolph. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Love and I interested me so that I dared to knock at the door of the cosmos.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Solstice Celebration on Thursday, June 28th at 6:30 p.m. at EcoTrust in Portland. The Portland Solstice Celebration is a benefit party and open house in support of Rogue Farm Corps and their work training new farmers and preserving farmland. The event features live music, food and drinks, a raffle, and more. Again, that's the Portland Solstice Celebration on Thursday, June 28th from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at EcoTrust, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is celebrating 50 years of broadcasting and the many people who are part of KBOO's history.
KBOO, I really think, is a good resource, and they give a voice to people who might be isolated or disfranchised. I thought that was good, how they put it in their mission statement.
KBOO was a lot of activity, and I was struck by the diversity. It was very welcoming, and I thought, this is something I like to be involved with.
The day I walked in, it was during pledge drive, and I was immediately pulled over to the membership drive table, which was in the front lobby, and we were all talking on the air about why you should join KBOO, and it was fun.
To hear the stories of people who helped make KBOO what it is today, go to 50yearsofkboo.fm and click on KBOO Stories Project.
This is KBOO Portland.
Good morning. Welcome once again to Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO. My name is Paul Rowland. I've got three guests this morning, one in the studio, one by phone from Ireland, and one by phone from Southeast Idaho, I believe she said. Let me introduce them in order. In the studio, we have Deborah Schwarzkopf, who I've had on at least a couple times now. Morning, Deborah.
Good morning, Paul. Thanks for having me.
All three are survivors of the brutal electroshock treatment, otherwise known as electroconvulsive therapy. Deborah lives not far from here in McMinnville. She's involved in a class action lawsuit, which she can't talk too much about because it is currently trying to be certified for appeal before the Ninth Circuit, I believe. And she has a website. What is the name of your website again?
ECT Justice.
Actually, let's adjust your microphone. We're going to have a little noise here. There we go, ectjustice.com. Okay, and on the phone from Ireland is a electroshock survivor, human rights activist, and co-founder of Mind Freedom Ireland, which is a branch of Mind Freedom International, which was actually started right here in Eugene, Oregon. And good morning, Mary Maddock.
Good morning, Paul. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Quite welcome. And on the other line, if all has worked out properly, is Jane Rice, who's a childhood psychiatric and shock survivor who writes about shock and other psychiatric atrocities with goals beyond informing. She hopes also that will also provide solutions and encourage self-advocacy. She's also got a website, lifeafterect.com, and she has various handles. Actually, her handle is at lifeafterect on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Good morning, Jane.
Hi, thank you, Paul, for having us.
You're so welcome. Looks like it worked. Here we all are. And I don't know, I want to start out. I just pulled up this article by Bruce Levine, a psychologist who I much respect, who I've had on the air, Electroconvulsive Therapy and Women. Since you're all women, it seems from what I've read, the overwhelming number of people who receive electroshock are women. Anybody want to tackle that?
Yes, this is very much the case. As you know, I'm from Ireland, and in Ireland it's the very same. When the records came out, which we had a long job in getting them out in the first place, we found that 2 to 1 women receive electroshock, and particularly elderly women. And I think in most countries that there's been research done on it, we found the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a piece, The Truth About Electroconvulsive Therapy, from 2015. And it says that I think 95% of what she calls shock doctors are men. Fancy that.
Yes.
And of course, yes. There's a Phyllis, I guess it, Phyllis Chesler wrote a book, Women in Madness, a while back, which kind of outlined the patriarchal nature of this sort of psychiatric abuse. Anyway, we can talk about that more as we go along. I'd like to explore that if you wish. Let's before we get into a little bit of the abbreviated update, since Deborah can't talk too much about this lawsuit. I just want Deborah to you got back in touch with me. What are some of the new things that have happened since, I guess, the 6 months since you've been on?
Well, as far as the lawsuit goes, it's in the Ninth Court of Appeals in California and currently impacts California residents. It impacts patients that have had electroshock in the last 2 years. At one point, it looked like it was going to extend back to 1982, but currently it looks like it will just impact patients in the last 2 years. It is in appeal currently for class action. There is also another class action suit filed with regards to the FDA and electroshock, but I'm not really clear on the details around that suit. And we are starting to look into trying to bring medical malpractice suits around electroshock, as standard of care is not being met with regards to informed consent.
Yeah, it just blows my mind. We've talked about this when you're on before, but the idea that it's still classified as an experimental device, yet they haven't really tested it. Seems like experimental means testing. So there's something very, just talk a little bit more about that. And also that the Federal Food and Drug Administration, which oversees this device, strangely, since it's not a food or a drug, it wants to declassify it and move it from experimental to some other classification.
Yeah, they're trying to declassify it from class 3, which is experimental, for both the procedure and the device, to a class 2. And they want to do that so more insurers will pay on this procedure. The devices were grandfathered in greater than 70 years ago and have never had to have pre-market approval before the FDA. And where they are faulty in consent is patients aren't warned that both the procedure and the device are classes experimental. So that is illegal not to warn patients.
And you're also saying that the FDA wants to move on this now, both because of the insurance, but you said there's another reason.
Oh no, you and I were talking about all the press that's coming out.
Oh, yeah.
Around pro shock now, pro electroshock, and whether it's the Anderson Cooper article on 60 Minutes,
the piece,
or various other articles that have recently come out promoting electroshock. My feeling is it's because the FDA is trying to declassify this now, and there are two class actions currently filed around this.
And that piece was May 13th, Is Shock Therapy Making a Comeback, which brought Kitty Dukakis prominently. And as you said, Deborah, I wasn't aware of this, that apparently she's sort of the poster child for a supposedly kinder, gentler electroshock. But anyway, people can call in later, after we hear a little more from our guests. The number will be 503-231-8187. Jane, I'm sure some of the things are it's all similar since the treatments are similar, but let's go to Mary, since you might have some different perspective being in Ireland. You don't have the Food and Drug Administration. Maybe talk about what some of the issues, similar issues and different issues you're facing over there.
Yes. Well, I believe the reason why they are pursuing electroshock so much is because we now are discovering how bad the drugs are as well, and that's coming out more and more. So psychiatry bases all its all the way it acts on what is known as the medical model. So if they don't have something else to fall back on, they'll feel they have nothing. Whereas we know, who have been through psychiatry, but we are very holistic, a person is, but you can't treat a person like as if they're a thing, something to be experimented on. And that's why psychiatry is protecting all the sort of ways that it has coded the people in the past. And I definitely have been one of those. And I know so many others, so many. I'm will be talking to somebody around the psychiatry and the way it behaves in the world most days of my life.
Unfortunately, although it's a landline, it's not the line isn't totally clear. I'm not sure if there's anything you can do to make that better. It's just a little staticky. I guess it's probably because it's an international call. I would like to hear a little bit about your story. I'm always so, shocked, disturbed, and also impressed in hearing these stories, Deborah's and others I've read about, including yours. The story you sent me, that how fragile we are as mortal beings, but also how strong and resilient we are in coming back from some of the most terrible events and treatments and traumas. Maybe you could just briefly talk a little bit about your story.
Okay, and that would be very true. Exactly what you've just said is that so many of us have been harmed by psychiatry, and the harm that has been done to us is incredible, absolutely incredible. The harm that was done to me started out at the very beginning when I was having my first baby, and it was assumed that I was in an altered state because prior to the birth of my daughter, I was given some psychotropic drugs, and I was reacting to them and nitrous oxide as well. So 2 days later, I was in a psychiatric hospital, and on the third day, I received electroshock for the first time, and I never had anything to do with psychiatry before that, thankfully. And also, they never even looked to see what might have gone wrong around the birth or anything. They just took that sort of drastic action. And unfortunately, that is still the case to this very day. That was back in the 70s. It's even more so the case today, because at least I got as far as 26, 28 years of age. But children now are, you know, they're even born, you know, even before birth, they're affected, because women are taking antidepressants and all the kind of ways that the babies can be hurt in the womb and everything as well. So the whole thing has gathered momentum so much in the harm that the psychiatry is capable of doing. And I was just an innocent guinea pig, you know. I was very, very, very happily married, and I was looking forward to having my baby so much. And it's very interesting as well, in my notes, that they were thinking I really didn't want to have the baby at all, you know. The psychiatrists seem to think they have 20/20 vision as to what's going on in people's minds without
X-ray
having any
vision.
Sorry?
No, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. X-ray vision almost, is they think they have.
Yes, X-ray vision, yeah. Yes. So that basically was my introduction to psychiatry, my introduction to electroshock. Sometimes I got three seizures at a time. Fortunately, I managed to get my nurse to know something about what went on, because I wouldn't know otherwise, because everything that happened to me, mostly I don't remember because of getting electroshock as well. And it's just horrific. You know, the lack of information people have before they encounter psychiatry, and what can happen to them because of that. And it is a crime against humanity. It's a crime against the way that people are stopped up in their tracks. And to get to the other point, as you said to me about, you know, the resilience we have, even when awful harm is done to us. It wasn't until the year 2000 that I eventually got out of psychiatry, having been really, 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 really abused so badly, you know, by the way I was misinformed all the time. And then it was because of what I was on. I eventually ended up on three psychotropic drugs for the most of 20 years, and it was because one of them had to be taken away that I actually realized that drug actually was the cause of my problem. And then, of course, we started investigating, myself and my husband. We encountered amazing people across the water where you live, and, you know, all the especially psychiatric survivors and their allies. I've met so many people who have encouraged me so much to speak out, and I've done that ever since 2000. And each day of my life, I feel stronger and stronger. And now I've just turned 70. Mm-hmm. So I'm 18 years now free from psychiatry, and they have been 18 amazing years, even though I started out being, you know, losing an awful lot of my capacity.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll talk more about your activism along with that of Deborah and Jane. Let's turn to Jane and you give us a little of your background, how you became a psychiatric survivor and activist.
Sure, and I'm really glad you brought up, you know, the issue of women being the primary target, because I do want to get more into this and then the story of another survivor. So I was misdiagnosed bipolar as a child, and polypharmacied, for those who don't know what that means on multiple different types of psychiatric meds, from age 11 to 24. After years of unsuccessful drug treatment and abusive therapy, I was labeled treatment resistant and was told by a trusted doctor that ECT was a safe option when nothing else worked. So from 2011 to 2007, I had around 80 to 90 ECT treatments starting at age 17. That's 80 to 90 electrically induced closed head injuries before my brain even finished developing. Not long before my last series of ECT treatments, the meds I was on began causing crippling side effects, one of which is called gastroparesis. It's extremely painful and disabling. I was bedridden and basically starved because eating was too painful. I basically ate a couple of spoonfuls of rice just to serve as a buffer for the narcotics that I was prescribed to deal with the pain. It hurt to stand up, even just for a few minutes at a time. You know, I'm not a nice person when I'm in pain. I was really miserable. So I couldn't be around anybody. I was completely isolated and, you know, suffering from these drug side effects. You can't just quit psych meds. You have to carefully taper them off one at a time. And because I believed I had a brain disease and that all hell would break loose if I wasn't on some medication, as the doctors led me to believe, we had to try and find replacement meds. And this led to some really horrific side effects, the main ones being, severe migraines, and the worst of them being akathisia. It's a horrible, sometimes life-threatening condition where there's too much serotonin in the brain. And if you read about it online, it does not describe it. It felt like every nerve on my body was on fire. I would have done anything to make it stop, jump out of a building, stick a gun in my mouth, anything. And I probably would have killed myself had my parents not returned home when they did. This led to my last series of ECT treatments. One thing that advocates of ECT say is that, they can help taper you off drugs faster, do the transition faster. I don't even know how they come up with that. And so during that last series of treatments, I didn't feel right. I felt something fell off. And so I told my doctor before leaving the hospital, and he told me to just come in for my next treatment. And, I was dazed, and I was in an impossible situation. I mean, it had probably been close to a year that I had been dealing with gastroparesis and dealing with all these drug side effects. And so I did. And when I woke up, it felt like my brain had been taken apart and put back together wrong. I lost all sense of time. My vision became distorted. I couldn't take care of myself anymore. I couldn't do basic tasks like laundry. I had speech problems and nearly went mute out of frustration for a while because I couldn't find words. Like, I'd lose them before they'd even get to my mouth. I couldn't understand people. It took me too long to process what they were saying, or I'd forget it, and, the instant they said it. I couldn't process emotions. I felt numb. I couldn't watch movies or play video games. And while that might sound trivial to people, that was the one thing that was keeping me from losing my mind, from being stuck in bed and isolated. So there was no mental escape from the pain I was feeling, from the drug withdrawal, from all of these things. And my depression was as severe as ever. There was just no escape. I tapered off drugs without going on new ones, and that took about a year, including the narcotics taper. I tried multiple times to get help for my brain damage, and I was just repeatedly told, ECT doesn't do that, you're fine, and so I probably, to them, just looked like a crazy delusional patient, just trying to make sense of my experience and, blaming ECT or whatever. I don't even know what they thought.
Did you wean yourself off the drugs all by yourself without any real...
No. Uh-huh. This was closely monitored by my doctor.
Okay.
I was able to get cognitive testing years later for an unrelated reason, and that saved me. It made it possible for me to get my GED, get speech and occupational therapy, and so on. And after about 5 years of research and doctor's appointments, I was able to get my health straightened out and figure out the real sources of my depression. It wasn't caused by a biological brain disease, but, I was diagnosed with chronic hypoglycemia as a child, but that never factored in on people. That can cause rapid mood swings, panic, crying, insomnia, anger, just the full spectrum of human emotions on crack.
Well, that's kind of mind-blowing to hear that, though, because, the vaunted medical model pretends to you know, see this, you know, these all these these mental symptoms of mental illness as, you know, something in the brain, whereas you're saying that actually it did have a possibly, apparently, from what you're saying, a physical cause, but only not the one that they seem to be focusing on.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. Our medical system is so partitioned off. You look at various health conditions, and a lot of times, you know, they treat the body like it's broken up into parts. But the mind and the body are one whole system. But that's not how everybody's been trained and not how everybody views it. And in addition to, you know, the blood sugar problem, I developed polycystic ovarian syndrome in my teens, for which I was given all kinds of hormone therapy, birth control, eventually estrogen suppression, which can cause massive, massive depression. And, you know, shock treatment and drugs, they don't fix that. I had some hidden learning disabilities, which wrecked my self-esteem. And I also found out that I had a condition called sensory processing disorder their whole life, because they might seem smart and capable of doing things, but they're not able to, and so it's just this back and forth, back and forth.
So let me warn you against certain words. I had to suppress about a minute of what you just said. Gotta be careful what you say.
Okay, I'll try and filter myself better.
Yeah.
yeah. So kids with hidden learning disabilities, things like that, they're in for a very rough life if they don't get them addressed and, you know, get them the tools that they need so they can be successful, become successful adults. And, you know, all of these problems, my doctor was aware of the hypoglycemia, although most doctors actually don't believe it's real outside of diabetes. It's just not in their training. A lot of them don't cover it. There's no real good, solid dietary advice coming from medical professionals right now for people how to manage it. And I actually have another friend who's a shock survivor who has hypoglycemia as well. And that also led to, you know, him needing ECT. But, you know, with the polycystic ovarian syndrome, all of these hormone problems, doctors, even OBGYNs to some extent, are pretty oblivious to how hormone shifts affect women. And how devastating they can be. If you look at the history of psychiatry in general, it's horrible, the stuff that they've done to women, because it's based from kind of a patriarchal viewpoint, and just viewing women as hysterical, you know, crazy things. And, you know, like Mary, she had problems after having her baby that led to ECT.
I was reading in this article that I mentioned earlier, The Truth About Electroconvulsive Therapy, by a woman, I believe from Australia, says women's higher susceptibility to depression than men, quote, most probably lies in a combination of biological, genetic, psychological, and social factors, not least of which is obviously the patriarchal social system that we live in. And you're bringing up. So,
can I come in there?
Yeah, please do, Mary.
Yes. I happen to be on a program here in Ireland with one of the psychiatrists who actually saw electroshock for what it was. His name is Michael Carr. He's no longer with us. And he was asked, you know, why do women seem to get depressed more than men? And his answer was, isn't it a man's world? And isn't it a man's world? Isn't it a man's world from all this? You know, like, women find it much harder to survive in this world. We're supposed to be, you know, more or less the same amount of men as women in the world as well. And, you know, like, women have to struggle so much harder to, you know, to be themselves, to do the things that women like to do. When you're talking about depression, it's the way the world is, it's the way we are, it's the way women are more, they're more sensitive, we can respond to things, we can respond to each other better as well, because nature made us that way. We were made that way. We are the ones who bring life into the world. So we need to be more sensitive to life. Men have their own great qualities as well, but unfortunately, often it's kind of a war between the two sexes, you know, which is the one that's the most important. We should complement each other rather than struggle with each other.
Well, it seems like men are.
What do you think?
It's kind of a men seem to be able to detach. We seem to be able to detach, which is exactly it gets to the part of the heart of the problem. You know that this sort of supposed objectivity, and it leads to these monstrous outcomes. I want to bring it back to the activist side. Maybe since I want to go there. Mary, talk a little bit about Mind Freedom International, what that is, and your involvement with it.
Yes, it was after I realized all the damage that was done to me by psychiatry. I looked up on the internet. I tried to look up on the internet. You know, were there any other people like me in the world? I didn't know. So Mind Freedom International came up pretty fast, and David Oakes was the leader of Mind Freedom International, and what an amazing man he has been. He lives somewhere around you, doesn't he? Aren't you, David?
David Oakes, yeah, in Eugene, yeah. I knew him. He was first a forest activist in the scene back in the early 80s, and then he got into this. Well, he got, I guess it was kind of parallel, because he had his issue was, I guess, he was going to, I believe, Harvard, maybe. Anyway, he had some issues in college that led to psychiatric abuse. Anyway, I used to know him quite well. I guess he had an accident not too long ago, so maybe I hear
that's
he's...
Right. That's right. He's coming back pretty well, too, now, which is great. Anyway, I realized then that there were more psychiatric survivors, and at that time, Mind Freedom International had a hunger strike, and they were asking the psychiatrist to you know, the question about where is your evidence for that these are actually diseases. These are based in biology, the way that what you're saying. And of course, they couldn't give any answers. All they told them to do was go to some books and something else. And, you know, obviously, if you have an answer, you'd be able to say it straight away. So I was very impressed by this happening in the world. My goodness, I couldn't believe it. And when I looked up the website and everything as well. So that gave me great encouragement. Now, when you go back to that time, that was just after 2000, I was so damaged by psychiatry that I found it hard to read, I found it hard to write, I found it hard to do all the things that I did very easily prior to psychiatry. And one of the things that I'm very, you know, I was a music teacher, music was so much part of my life, and that was all taken away from me, and electroshock had a role to play in that, because I was able to play music very well, because I had to, in order to get the exams to be a music teacher. So afterwards I couldn't play these pieces, and I never even thought about why then, because I wasn't capable of thinking, because I had been so drugged afterwards as well. So for me to really see my own story and see how psychiatry did damage me, that was impossible for me too. But to get back to Mind Freedom International, then I thought it would be great if, you know, we could connect with Mind Freedom International. I didn't even know there was affiliates at the time, and I couldn't believe it, because I thought, this is a global movement. This is a movement that affects all of us so much in the world today. This is something that is a monster in society, and people need to know about it. We all need to know about it. We all need to know that you could be one who is damaged. You could be one that's damaged by electroshock. You could be one that's damaged by all these drugs and find yourself in the place that Deborah and Jane and I have found ourselves, and many, 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 many more. So it was wonderful then to feel that I could connect with people. I could connect with people across the world. We went across to meet the people over there and everything. I went across to meet people in other countries as well, to actually meet people who were like me and connect with, not just with psychiatric survivors, with allies, as I like you mentioned. I always forget his name, the man that wrote the article, you know, at the beginning.
Did I mention? Bruce Levine, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, you met him?
No, I didn't meet him, but he impressed me so, so much in all the articles he wrote. He was, you know, I'd get them through Mind Freedom International as well. And I started contributing big time to Mind Freedom International then, because I began to be able to use the internet slowly. I was like somebody coming back on my feet again, you know, that couldn't walk.
So I just want to...
Each time I took... Sorry.
Well, no, I just want to mention it. This is a talk show. If people want to call in and join this conversation or ask any questions, it's a 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. We only have one line open because we have our two guests on the phone. I just want to, this is what we were talking about, this 60 Minutes piece, Is Shock Therapy Making a Comeback, which just aired in May. Just a little over a month ago, and had Kitty Dukakis on, and the whole issue of a media discussion of this. I want to get back to Deborah and have Jane and Mary chime in as well. I know Deborah, you were talking before the show about how you've approached many media outlets, and they seem to kind of drop it like a hot potato.
Yes, I joined Press Rush, which gives you access to give pitches to journalists, and I've approached literally thousands of journalists internationally, and there is interest in doing stories. They interview myself, they've interviewed peers, and then they drop the story. It doesn't go anywhere. It's not printed. ABC7 in New York City was interested in doing an investigative piece over a couple of months, and that too was dropped. And so so social media is the way to get the word out. And
KABU.
And KABU too. Thank you. I'm very sorry. It's early in the morning. And so social media and KABU and hopefully other outlets will bring attention to this.
Well, let me, so you know, the is this, how does it feel to be, you know, telling your story publicly? I'm sure this isn't the first time, Mary and Jane, I know Deborah, you've been on this show, but do you feel like people are really paying attention in terms of the mass media, or do you feel the same as Deborah, that people really are shying away from digging deeper into the really dark history of not just the history, but the, you know, the way it is making, as 60 Minutes said, it is actually making a comeback, and this attempt to sort of portray it as a kinder, gentler, with lowered dosages of electricity and I guess more care. I guess they inject people with a relaxant or something to, so you don't have the really fierce convulsions that can also damage you. Well, I guess Deborah wants to first tackle that, but then let's go to Jane and Mary afterwards. Go ahead, Deborah.
Yeah, I wanted to say, no matter if you use the anesthetics or the paralytics, the trauma, it comes down to trauma, and all trauma is based on what is known as mechanism of trauma. And if you have the electrical mechanism of trauma that results in entero and retrograde amnesia, you've induced a traumatic brain injury. That's what it comes down to. So that's all I have to say about it.
And it's ironic in a sense that we're talking about the brain injuries in the NFL, but we're allowing massive brain injuries to continue through this.
Right. And how it seems effective in the cases of depression is that in traumatic brain injury, it is not uncommon to experience euphoria that it can extend out weeks. And it's not uncommon to experience the Antero and retrograde amnesia for difficulties that led to admission, so the patient appears better. And so with those two factors, then that looks like improvement on the unit. But when those symptoms of the euphoria wear off in about 6 weeks, then you're going to have your extensive neurocognitive damages to deal with and nobody to validate you. And that's when people start killing themselves secondary to this procedure because they can find no help in addressing these injuries.
Let's go back to Jane. We haven't heard from you in a little bit. Why don't you weigh in on this?
Yeah, so it's not a feeling that the media is ignoring the negative aspects of ECT. There's a fantastic book by a shock survivor, Linda Andre, called Doctors of Deception, and she has a whole chapter dedicated to how the media has covered ECT throughout history. It has deliberately suppressed or worked in favor of this industry. It's not, I don't even know what I was going to say. It's real. It's one of the most insane things I've ever seen, I think. People lose their minds over ECT. I can walk up to somebody and tell them my doctor damaged my brain with electric convulsive therapy, and they're not going to believe me because people implicitly trust doctors, were taught to do that, and it just doesn't make sense. You know, I've been doing a lot of research on understanding logical fallacies and stuff because, like, this is just the most insane thing, you know. People don't believe us. People won't listen to us, or people will side with the people that feel quote-unquote helped. And that's never the issue, and that's something that I've really been trying to hammer home with my activism, because I've been on the good side of ECT, and I've been on the bad side of ECT. But the difference is there are factors like the things that Deborah mentioned, and so much more, that don't change, you know, whether you have a good experience or a bad experience. You know, this is the same. These devices haven't been FDA tested. You know, they're saying that ECT is safer and gentler. That is simply not true. You know, just because you're not thrashing around on the table does not mean that you are not undergoing something catastrophic. Seizures are bad. They can kill people. I have a friend who died from a seizure disorder. The body tries to fight seizures, and so the more ECT treatments that you get, the higher your body raises the seizure threshold, which needs more and more electricity. And just with the anesthesia, they have to use more electricity, because when you are unconscious, your seizure threshold is raised. There is evidence of, there's shock proponents telling prospective shock students that, you know, you should increase the electricity, because they've tried doing low electricity ECT machines, and the effects just weren't there, because the effects come with brain damage. There is an excellent piece written by a paralegal who defended an ECT survivor who lost all of his autobiographical memories, and he outlines, you know, how the literature shows that organic brain syndrome, it happens when your brain is damaged, is the real effect, and people's brain function, it completely alters while they're recovering from ECT, and that's why it can, you know, benefits and stuff, they can seem to last for like a year or two even, because the person's in almost kind of like a dreamlike state. Of course, you know, it's like, oh, go ahead.
Well, I just want to flag one thing you said. I want to make sure I got this right. I think I understand you to say that there's something like there is tolerance to drugs, there's tolerance to ECT. Were you saying that?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and you can find that in the literature. Your seizure threshold. I mean, it's an important thing that humans have a seizure threshold. It prevents us from having spontaneous seizures, and you know, these are life threatening. And so it will continue to raise it. It will develop some sort of resistance to it, and they'll have to keep increasing the electricity. And, you know, another problem is when you hear people that have just had one series of ECT treatments, and those people are propped up as, oh, this person was saved by this medication. It might not have worked for so-and-so who had 90 treatments. But you have to understand that the more you have, the more consecutive damage you'll get. And so a one-series person, you know, that is, you know, still fairly functional, they can't really speak to the person who's had 90 treatments, you know, somebody like me who has, you know, chronic encephalopathy, no short-term memory, and, you know, all kinds of problems.
Hmm. Let's go back to Mary. You know, I'm sure you're also encouraged by the recent vote on abortion in Ireland, so at least you've got one strike against the patriarchy there. What sort of reaction have you gotten from activists in other areas, like Jane was saying, that people just don't believe her. Talk. How is it going to get the word out there in Ireland about the issue?
We've had many electroshock protests now in Ireland. We've had over 10, and we're out on the streets of Cork. And when most people, you know, engage with us, they don't even believe it's still going on in the hospitals. That's their reaction. The average person can't believe that this is still part of what happens in psychiatric hospitals. And we did get some coverage, you know, very tiny coverage in the media, but I was on a few programs, but what they tend to do, the media does, it actually tries to use you to make the other side seem better. You know, the people who actually see what's going on. Because the media have vested interests, you know, the established media. I'm not talking about people like you. I'm talking about people who are, you know, have big business in media.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to want to hear the voice of people like us who have been damaged by psychiatry, because it's not what they're... There's too much money in it being the way it is.
Do you have something like community radio? Do you have something like community radio there?
Have a community? Yes, here in Cork, we have local radio stations as well, you know, and they would be better than the main big stations as well. You know, the bigger anything is, usually the worse it gets. Isn't that true for nearly everything?
It does seem to be.
And also, I would appeal to the common sense of the average person, that giving a seizure to somebody, how in honor of God is that going to be good for the total person? You know, the actual common sense of it, without having any research. You know, we have all these people talking about research on this, that, and the other, but common sense would say damaging something in order to help somebody is not a good idea. And also, one of the most beautiful statements that I nearly always quote by C.S. Lewis is, of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victims may be the most oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's psychiatry in a nutshell, with its EC trauma, because T is not therapy, and with its electroshock, its lobotomy in the past, its insulin coma treatments, so-called, its drug treatments that are all poisons, that are poisoning the people. How in honor of anything could that be a solution to human problems?
Well, we don't have any... do we have a caller? Okay. So we may be able to take calls in a minute here. 503-231-8187. I guess the other line is occupied temporarily. There's these two lawsuits, which are probably going to take years if they end up going through. That's one route. And we hope that they do have their effect. They're one against the FDA, and one is against somewhat limited by the courts, but hold the manufacturer or more manufacturers of these devices accountable. So what other strategies are being pursued? Deborah, Jane, Mary, what other things are happening in the anti-shock movement at this time?
So I'd like to talk about another survivor and make a point. It's something that I would like to see happen.
Mm-hmm.
I help admin an international shock survivor support group on Facebook, and last year we had a young mother join our group. I'll call her Sarah. She had been battling postpartum depression for a year, and instead of giving her hormone therapy that would have corrected this life-threatening condition, she was given Zoloft, which made her suicidal. her doctor and family insisted she have ECT after she got off Zoloft and didn't get better. She didn't want to, but she did what she could to make them happy and hopefully feel better, and her brain was severely damaged and she quit early. Neither her family or her doctor believed anything was wrong. Her doctor refused to offer her support or alternate treatment unless she agreed to more ECT. Her parents cut her off also until she had more ECT, and her husband threatened to have her legally stripped of her custody of her daughter, of their daughter, and threatened to use her behavior caused by the distress of her brain damage against her. Judging from the conversations I had with her, I don't think her postpartum ever resolved. So on top of, you know, just having her life, basically her mind destroyed, not knowing who she, where she lived, what she ate for breakfast, you know, memories that made her the person that she was, you know, she was also probably dealing with postpartum on top of that. Many survivors reached out to her, but, you know, there's only so much you can do. She had killed herself a few weeks later. And so the point that I want to make in the direction I want to see this movement go is this. The psychiatric reform movement is making progress. You know, drug taper programs are being made. Continuing education programs are being put out by reputable organizations like Mad in America. And it's becoming more mainstream that, you know, the drugs aren't what they said, and a lot of the diagnoses, you know, are crap, basically. It's been 88 years since the invention of ECT, and there's never been comprehensive, tangible support for shock survivors. You know, we are on our own. I know people who are trapped in abusive families, and like the woman who died, you know, ECT abolition is a great goal, and we need to strive for that. But, you know, it could be 10 years from now. It could be another 80 years. And we need help now. You know, ECT doesn't have to be abolished for people to help us. There are dozens of ways people can help in the mental health system, and it won't cost, you know, it doesn't cost money to build a network of psychologists or counselors or social workers who are aware of the risks and the things that can happen. Even if you're not anti-ECT, you know, you can still help. If you're not anti, if you're not in the reform movement, you know, I mean, I'm offering this to you potential clients. You know, if you are a counselor, if you're in the mental health field, you know, send me a message, you know, on Facebook, you know, email me at Aftershock Recovery, so I can connect people with you that need help. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, as an admin, I can't do anything.
So, it's, I'm sorry for all the damage that's been done to you and others. Go ahead, Deborah.
And the suicide of that woman that many of us knew is not all that uncommon to have happen. And we become very close to our peers. And when one of us commits suicide, it's devastating to many.
And I think, Deborah, you wrote in a Facebook post that I read earlier that the increased attention being given to suicide, you're saying, might have a strange effect of actually encouraging ECT use as a possible suicide prevention. Is that?
Well, yeah, because it's promoted as saving people's lives if they're suicidal, but there's actually a twofold increase in suicide following electroshock because of the neurocognitive damages that patients live with and not being addressed. And if you have football players that are having real issues after two or three concussions, imagine, you know, what we live with after 6 up to 90, whatever, you know, it devastates people's lives.
And we only have about 6 minutes left. I know we had a line occupied there. There is a line open now, 503-231-8187, if you want to get in a quick question or comment. And again, ectjustice.com is Deborah's website. And Jane Rice, her website is lifeafterect.com. And Mary Maddock works with Mind Freedom International, and they're centered in Eugene, so you can get in touch with them. Go ahead, Mary.
Yes, and I also have Facebook pages as well. One of them is No More Electroshock as well, and that's what we want, to abolish electroshock, because why would doctors do harm to people? Why would they decide that it's good to harm people? Doctors should examine themselves and say, we won't harm people anymore. We won't provide that harm. So if it's not there, it can't be done.
Okay, we do have a caller on the line.
As my friend said, sorry.
No, well, we do have a caller on the line, so let them get in a quick comment. Go ahead, Dennis. Yeah. You're on the air.
Yeah. Thank you. I turned down my radio. I guess I should turn down my radio.
Yes.
Okay. So, I had some experiences. Well, in the mental health community, I never had ECT, but I knew of a there's a well known. I think he's well known. Poet. His name is David Fisher. I wonder if he have ever heard of him. He graduated summa cum laude from Duke University, and then he went on to Harvard, and he went through some bad times, and he was given electroshock. This was about at least 30 years ago, before there was any attempt to regulate it, and he wrote a book called The Book of Madness, and as far as I know, he may still be living. He's getting older. He would be getting older now. He was living for a while in people at the University of California at Santa Cruz knew of him, and then and then I think he moved to the area.
Okay. So the question is: have people heard of David Fisher? Is that the question?
Yes. He was very.
No, I've not heard of him.
Okay, we only have a couple minutes left, Dennis, so we're going to have to move on. We have to wrap up the show, but thank you for calling. So Book of Madness by David Fisher. Any final thoughts here? We only have a couple minutes left. Jane?
I would like to invite people, even if you're not a psychiatric patient, if you haven't dealt with depression, if you're in the U.S., this should matter to you because your taxpayer dollars are funding ECT. They're funding the brain damage people like me are receiving, and they're also paying for the disability benefits that most of us end up on afterwards. What happens, what the FDA decides with ECT will affect the rest of the world. We are a major influencer, and so, somewhere down the road, if ECT is class action too, there's a chance that you or one of your family members, should you undergo hard times or whatever, might have suggested it, it might be forced on you. This is affecting, countless people, and this affects you. There are ways you can get involved. Call your congressperson, support our lawsuits, support our websites, learn about this, because this is happening, and this affects everyone.
And the FDA process, Deborah, is there any way to intervene and to come? Is there like a comment period or anything? Is there anything public about this FDA process?
I'm not up on what's going on with the FDA.
Okay.
So,
and Mary, okay. any final thoughts for us?
Thank you. Can I say that while we have these damaging, brain damaging, they call treatments around, It's much harder for us to have good help for people who want help there. So we should, with all our might, try to rid ourselves of these. We are rid of insulin coma treatment, we're rid of lobotomy, but they're holding on to the others. And while they hold on to those, it's much harder for us. And I would say to every person, remember that if you want something good for you and for others, we don't need them, and we need to have caring people who will support and love each other.
Okay, we gotta end in a second here. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Mary. We gotta end here. Second, Deborah had one last thought.
Thank you, Paul, for having us all on. I'm very appreciative.
You're quite welcome, and we've been hearing, you just heard Deborah Schwarzkopf here in the studio, Mary Maddock from Ireland, and Jane Rice from Idaho. Coming up will be Linda Olsen Osterlund live in the studio with her guest, and this has been Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned next week for a July 4th special.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Cherry Blossom Orchestra on Wednesday, June 27th at 8 p.m. at the No Vacancy Lounge in Portland. The evening centers on the historic performance of Jansen Hop, a piece of music written in Portland in 1931 to be performed at Jansen Beach's Golden Canopy Ballroom. It was never recorded. The night also features a 90th birthday tribute for Louis Armstrong's West End Blues and much more. Again, that's the Cherry Blossom Orchestra on Wednesday, June 27th at 8 p.m. at the No Vacancy Lounge, 235 Southwest 1st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor IRANFORM, U.S. Withdrawal from Nuclear Agreement and Path to War, on Friday, June 29th at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. The Iran Forum will feature Jamal Abdi, Executive Director of the National Iran American Council, journalist Reese Ehrlich, and local speakers in a discussion about withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal. The sponsoring groups are involved in prevention of war and in supporting diplomacy and friendship with the people of Iran. Again, that's the Iran Forum U.S. Withdrawal from the Nuclear Agreement and Path to War on Friday, June 29th at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned at 10 this morning for Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. Then at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, The Recovery Zone talks to Paul Levy about his new book, The Quantum Revelation, a new paradigm for humanity revealed through the science of quantum theory. Portland area weather is going to be great, near 73 tonight, today, and mostly cloudy tonight, and then on it goes into the summer. Stay tuned now, because Political Perspectives features Linda Olson Osterlin, who's going to speak with Medea Benjamin, Code Pink co-founder. They'll be discussing peace movements in Iran and North Korea. That coming up on KBOO, member-supported community radio.